organizers for having us here in this very nice and stimulating workshop. So the talk I'm presenting is about testing hypotheses about the causal structure. So the setting I will consider is a setting where we have different prior hypotheses of how we think that a bunch of variables are related to each other, and the goal is to identify which hypothesis is correct. A relation with the previous talk by Lucien is that to test causal hypotheses, I will emphasize a lot the role of intervention and how it is important to plan carefully our interventions in order to maximize our chances to find the right hypothesis. So this is a joint work with Daniel Ebler, who is a PhD student in Hong Kong, and is about to finish his PhD now. He really worked all his PhD on these problems of quantum causality and also of indefinite causal order. But this talk will be completely about ordinary causality with a fixed order. Okay, let me give a little bit of background about causal inference. This is, about classical causal inference, to start from what is well known and established. So this is a very big topic. It is a broad topic at the interface between computer science and statistics, and it has been applied, and the results of this research are normally applied in a diversity of different fields, including even medicine, genetics, or whatever case where we care about determining the causal relations among a set of variables. So the problem is broadly to discover causal relationships or to test them. And there are at least two big reference books. One is the one by Pearl, and the other is by Spiertes, Gleamer, and Shines. So there is a lot of work already being done in this area. I think the key idea for those who are not familiar with causal discovery is the idea that we say that a random variable A is a cause for B whenever our ability to intervene on the variable A will have a visible effect on variable B. Typically, this means that intervening on A will change the statistics of the variable B. And you can imagine a lot of examples, maybe having to do with the drug tests or tests of whether a certain measure will cause economic growth or not. So this is a kind of a very broad idea. One of the caveats that are very common in this area is the idea that correlations do not imply causation. So it's not enough to study the natural correlations between two variables in order to be able to establish a causal link. The important thing is that you should be able somehow to test different settings for the variable that you consider the cause. So you must be able to intervene in order to establish a causal relationship. A single joint probability distribution is not enough for that. And that's a very well-known slogan in classical causal inference. In recent years, there has been a lot of interest in generalizing these ideas to the quantum case, or even beyond the quantum case. So there is a more general area of studying causal inference in quantum theory and more general physical theories that we can imagine. So what has been done, it's been pretty much a generalization of the notion of causal relationship from classical random variables to random variables described by other physical theories, and also of the notion of causal network. So there are a lot of works and a lot of different frameworks. In the early works, it was mostly about studying how beliefs and how information propagates in a sequence of quantum operations. Then there were works that became kind of more abstract and more general, and like by Cook and Speckens, or Liefer and Speckens more recently. And also a series of works that studied the problem of causal relationships in theories that are more general than quantum mechanics, like this work by Hensel, Lal, and Pusey, and also by Pinar and Bruckner. So there has been a lot of work, and the most recent are about these works by Allen et al., and also a work by Rob and MacLean that appeared last year. So there is a lot of ongoing development on what do we mean by having causal relationships in quantum and more general theories. But again, the basic idea, if we neglect a little bit of differences among the frameworks, is that the variables, the random variables, are replaced by physical systems. So instead of having a random variable described by a bit, you could have a random variable described by a qubit or by a generalized bit. And the causal relation, the fact that there is a causal relation between variable A and variable B, that O, A is the cause for B, would mean that changing the state of variable A will induce a change in the state of variable B. Okay, so that's a kind of a general and broad idea of what a causal relation would mean in a general theory. Why do we care about this? Why do we even care about extending the framework of causal relationships to the case of quantum theory or even more general theories? Well, I would say that most people who are involved in this project care about them for foundational reasons. So it's kind of fascinating to understand the relation between quantum features like superposition, entanglement, non-locality, contextuality, and the features that have to do with the discovering causal relationships. This could also give us more insight into future physical theories that combine an important role of causality and an important role of quantum features. The obvious example is quantum gravity. I didn't even write it because it's kind of so obvious that I hope that there will be other examples other than that. But surely studying the interplay between causality and quantum features is definitely motivated partly by the study of quantum gravity. And another reason to study this is the project of axiomatizations of standard quantum theory without strange causal structures. We have seen a lot of works on axiomatizations, on information theoretic axioms. It's kind of fascinating and interesting to think that one could have an axiomatization where the axioms that we consider have something to do with the ability to distinguish causal relationships or to discover them. So a study of the relation between causality and quantum theory could give us input for new axiomatization and could give a new point of view on which axioms single out quantum theory. On a more practical point of view, this research is also useful to identify new types of quantum advantages, so new protocols and even new experiments that we may try to do. And somehow it also brings us in the direction of identifying working principles for new quantum devices. So somehow the idea here is to develop a technology of quantum causal inference. So like to help the development of devices that will actually do some tasks of causal inference using basic quantum primitives. Okay, these are the motivations. Let me go more into the details of what you are gonna see in this talk. So in this talk, I will focus on a specific task, not much on causal discovery, but on the task of testing different hypotheses on the causal structure. So instead of saying there are a bunch of variables and we don't know at all what are the relationships between them, I will say we have different hypotheses. We may assume that this variable causes that, or someone else could assume that this variable causes another thing. And the problem is to compare these hypotheses and to devise tests where we can figure out what is the right hypothesis with the minimum experimental complexity by querying this process the minimum number of times. So yes, the task of this talk will be the task of identifying the correct hypothesis on the causal structure given a set of given a prior knowledge and a set of hypotheses that we hold one of which we hold to be true. So let's go a little bit more in the detail, and let me give as a prologue, a little bit of information about an interesting example that was presented by some of our colleagues a few years ago. So the example works like this. So there are two different situations. There are two variables and two different situations. So here the two variables, the A and B variables, correspond to the red part of my circuit. So each variable here is associated to two different quantum systems, one input and one output. And the two variables are like what comes from our observations in this part of the circuit and in this part of the circuit. So there are two different situations. The one is that variable A, so our choice of measurement in one part of the circuit, causes B, so our choice of measurement in the other part of the circuit. That's the first hypothesis. The second hypothesis is that these two variables have a common cause, meaning that there was a physical system prepared earlier on, and these two measurements that we are doing are actually acting on in parallel on two different parts of on two different subsystems. So we could imagine that we get the statistical data coming from a situation that is promised to be either one or two, and the question could be to figure out from the statistical data whether we are in one situation or the other. So this was an example that was analyzed the first, in one variation was analyzed by Fitzsimmons et al. And later Reed and others developed more this idea, presenting other situations in which a similar way of distinguishing between A1 and 2 happens. So the idea here is that in quantum theory, there are some special scenarios in which you can tell situation 1 from situation 2 just by observing the statistics of projective measurements that are done, here and here or here and there in parallel. So you could see the statistics, and you need somebody to promise to you that this is the statistics of two projective measurements that happens to be the same, and the statistics has been obtained by scanning these two measurements over all possible settings. So imagine that in this part of the circuit you have the identity operation. So one measurement happens after the other. So if this is the same projective measurement, you expect to see what?
The same outcome,
because if you do the same projective measurement and you repeat it immediately after that, the repeatability of projective measurement will give you exactly the same statistic for every projective measurement you can make. So if you have this, if you see this in the statistics and you find perfect correlations for every possible setting, you can safely conclude that you are in situation one, whereas situation two would not be possible. So you cannot have perfect correlations in situation two. And the opposite situation is a situation where you do your two measurements. You always measure the same orthogonal measurement, the same projectors, and you find that you have perfect anti-correlations. So every time you measure, let's say, if these are two-dimensional systems, every time you measure zero on one side, on the other side you will find one. So if this happens for every possible setting, you can safely conclude that actually the measurements that you did were done on a singlet state. So they were done in situation two, and there is no way to have the same statistics when you are in situation one. So I found this a very fascinating observation, and I was wondering, what is this telling us? So one way, one interpretation, I wasn't only wondering, somebody asked me to write a commentary piece on these words, so I really had to go through the homework of thinking how would I interpret this observation. And what I was thinking is that this hints at the fact that quantum theory offers us new ways to test different causal hypotheses that were not possible in classical theory. So in classical theory, if we restricted ourselves to projective measurements, so projective classical measurements are the one where you really see the value of a variable and you don't change it, you leave it as it is. If we were to do that in classical theory, we would have no way to distinguish between these two hypotheses. Whereas in quantum theory, it seems that this type of observations would still allow you to distinguish between one situation and the other. So I found this very intriguing. But on the other hand, I was feeling that if this intuition is correct, we should be able to see an advantage of quantum theory over classical theory, even when we consider measurements that are not just projective measurements, not the measurements that we can interpret as purely observing the variable, because after all, the whole point of causal inference is to do interventions. So in a sense, this made me think that I wanted to see an example where the advantage of quantum theory is achieved without restricting the attention to kind of purely observational approaches, like the one in which we have the advantage here. So just repeating what I just said, so this is an intriguing observation, the fact that we, in quantum theory we can distinguish between these two scenarios, but still the type of advantage that we have is contingent on a particular restriction on which strategies you allow, which measurements or which type of interventions you allow. You're allowing, and the point that the two papers were making is that you're restricted to interventions that are as close as possible to just looking passively at the variables without actively intervening on them. So the motivating question for this work was, can we find advantages also in situations where we allow arbitrary interventions? So we want to compare, we have like a set of different hypotheses on the causal structure, and we want to compare them, taking the best we can do in quantum theory versus the best we can do in classical theory without putting any restriction on which strategies we can choose. So this is the motivation of the talk. You have any questions so far?
Just yep. Contingent on here means it's restricted to? Or?
I'm sorry if if this was maybe not the standard. Yes, I mean that you really need to restrict the comparison to some specific. Yes, this is what I meant. Yes.
Also, advantage means being able to explain, or
advantage would mean that it's not precisely specified yet. I mean, I would say like any different behavior between the two theories that looks like that we can do something in quantum theory that we couldn't do when we compare the same scenario with in classical theory. I mean, part of the talk is actually about building up a framework where you can talk about this comparison. So it's like I use a word before giving to it the precise mathematical meaning, which is what we're going to do in the next slides.
The possibility of generalization, what causality means in such like scenarios,
yes.
Different mathematical frameworks,
yes.
Round quantum theory and so on.
Yes. Okay, so that's the spirit. That's what I will be trying to do in the talk. So let's now go more into the details. So the first part of the talk is about establishing a framework and the notion of testing causal hypotheses in different physical theories. So I want to talk about testing between one hypothesis and the other without specifying which physical theory is underlying. And then I want to compare different physical theories for the same problem of testing the same type of hypothesis. So here is a little bit of an introduction to the basic notions. So most of us are used to the problem of causal discovery, where we have as input a bunch of random variables, or a bunch of variables in general, and as output we want to produce our best guess for the causal relationships between these variables. Okay? So you are given these variables, you can intervene on some of them, and you want to infer what causal relationships exist without having any prior. This is not what I do here in the talk. I will talk about hypothesis testing. So the input is a set of variables, as before, but also there is something more. We start from a set of hypotheses on the causal relationships among the variables. So easy example, I could have variables A, B, and C. One hypothesis could be that A causes B, and the other hypothesis could be that A causes C. And the problem may be to choose which of these two hypotheses is true, assuming that one and only one of the two is true. So the output here is to find the best guess for the correct hypothesis by actually probing this physical process that we've seen in the lab, and to devise a test that will choose what is the right hypothesis, assuming that the right hypothesis is one in the list that we start from at the beginning. Okay. So here is an example. So what do I mean by a causal hypothesis? An hypothesis on the causal structure is an hypothesis on a physical process that I can access as a black box in the lab, and I want to figure out what are the causal properties of that box. So here is one example. So this is pretty much the example I was mentioning before. So we could have a box, a black box in the lab, where there is an input system and two output systems. So the first hypothesis could be that the variable, the system A, causes the system B, so that changing the state of A implies a change of the state of system B. but not C. So meaning that changing the state of A would not lead to any change of system C. So in another corner of the literature, this is called the signaling versus no signaling condition. So here I mean that either we would have a signaling from A to B, but no signaling from A to C, or vice versa, we could have signaling from A to C, but no signaling from A to B. So these are the two hypotheses on the table. We can imagine that there are two people, one who believes that A causes B but not C, and the other believes that A causes C but not B. And we want to settle the question by devising an experiment where we probe these black boxes and we come up with our best guess on which of the two hypotheses is correct. Yes, there is a, I think, Rob, you have a question?
Yes, I just wanted to mention that this hypothesis testing is also what was done in the previous work. So distinguishing common cause from cause-effect.
Yes.
Given a promise, it's one of the two, as opposed to a cause-effect and a common cause relation.
Indeed. I mean, that's why I had exactly that example as a motivating example. Yes, actually, I simplified the slide by removing stuff that I had here, but I wanted to say, yeah, the example of the paper of yours and the one by Fitzsimmons and others would fit more this framework of causal hypothesis testing than the framework of causal discovery. I'm very happy that actually you agree on that. Yes, so yes, definitely this is motivated by the idea of generalizing what was done in those two papers and kind of studying it. Studying it, as I said, in terms of hypothesis testing here would mean that we will care about technical question of like, what is the rate of distinguishing the hypothesis? Yes, please.
So there's a typo there, right? One of them should be different.
Yes, that causes C but not B. Cut and paste is a devilish thing. Yes. Yes, A causes C but not B, thank you. Yes, so the point I wanted to stress, that's maybe why I forgot to update this thing, I was so eager to write this down, is that the causal hypothesis that we are making are independent of what underlying theory is there. So this is kind of an abstract property of what signals to what. You could think that your theory describing the device is classical theory. You could think that it's quantum theory. You could think that it's any theory, even a fictional theory, that you can come up with. And still this question makes sense. So it's the same question about distinguishing hypothesis one from hypothesis two that you can embed in different physical theories. So that's why I was stressing this a theory-independent framework. You first have the question, and then you embed the question in different theories, and you can compare how well different theories can do. Yep?
So you could also have A causing B and C.
Okay. Yes, yes.
But that's not a hypothesis because you might know something about the system that excludes
I mean, one important thing is that in order for these questions to make sense, you need to be able to say that these hypotheses are kind of alternative to each other and incompatible. Because one possibility, for instance, would be that A doesn't signal either like to B and to C. So just no information of A goes to B and C, in which case you would still be, in a sense, you would be here, in a degenerate sense of causing, so you would not change, but it depends on how you formulate the problem, at least. And you could have a situation where the intersection between one hypothesis and the other is non-empty, and in that case, the question itself doesn't make too much sense, unless, I don't know, you put a prior distribution of what these boxes can be, and you say, okay, the probability of the intersection is very small compared to the rest. In that case, I would consider how well I can distinguish on average. But here I will consider the problem in a situation where I guarantee that there is no intersection between one situation and the other, so it's really a well-defined question to distinguish. Yep.
Maybe a small comment. That is one difference, because the approach we took was that the output of the algorithm should be it's this, it's that, or it's consistent with both. So
yes.
In our case, we said we allowed that it's
yes.
Both hypotheses are consistent with
yes,
both.
Yes. In the basic version of this framework, I would stick to a situation where we really have to decide. But yes, one can expand the scope of this and include a situation where it's like either A or B or consistent with both. Okay, so what does it mean to test the hypothesis? In the most general scenario, you are in the situation of an experimenter who has to set up a test, to define a test, and has access to this black box for a finite number of time. So here I represented in blue, in light blue, the black box part of the circuit, and in red, because we put more emotions there, and the part representing the actions of the experimenter, who is, so all that is in red is what the experimenter is choosing actively to put there as an intervention, whereas the blue part is really the process that is sitting there cold in the lab, and we are trying to probe. So imagine that we can probe this process for n times. The most general thing that we can do, if we live in a world where the order of our operations is well defined, is to build a circuit of this form. So we could prepare an input for the first use of the process and correlate this input with some variable in our lab. And we will forward this variable, collect the outputs of the first use of the process, and then then process again this variable, send one to the input and keep one in the lab, and continue like this until the end, where in the end we will observe the data that come out, and we will use our observation to come up with a guess of what is the correct hypothesis. So eventually we'll produce a value x, and x would be like either 1 or 2, depending on which hypothesis is correct, or 1, 2, 3, 4 if there are more than 2 hypotheses. So this is really the most general type of intervention that we can allow in a generic situation where the experimentalist operates in a sequence of steps.
So you can imagine that the classical information is extracted at the intermediate steps and used to choose what subsequent steps were made.
Oh, yes, that's what this processing is doing.
And that line at the bottom could be the classical information.
Yes, could be classical quantum, like this is generic to different theories, but in particular could be classical data that is extracted.
Well, it's not necessarily a fixed circuit, but it is fixed. But it's...
It is fixed because there is an algorithm for how we will do these things, but it includes adaptation. It includes different ways to adapt. The choosing the next settings depending on statistics that we gather at intermediate steps. So all this is included. So other things that are included are like the obvious thing that we can try to do. One thing is to do process tomography, like guessing what this process is, what C is, and based on our guess also to establish in which direction this process signals. This is definitely included in this framework, because these interactions in that case would be somehow trivial, and we would have all these processes acting in parallel on states that are prepared always to be the same. So tomography is a special case of this general way of intervening in order to guess the causal structure. So pretty much all we are used to will fit in this framework. The only thing that wouldn't fit is the situation where the order in which the experimenter acts is indefinite, but I will not consider that in this talk. Okay, so an important notion when we do these experiments with a finite number of data is to see how your probability of error, how your probability of success depends on the number of experiments you do. So depending on how many times you query this black box. So here, as a figure of merit, I will consider the minimization of the probability to be wrong. So in the end, you will make your guess about what is the causal relationships, and I would like the probability to be as small as possible, compatible with the problem and with the physical theory that we are considering. I will take a worst-case approach. This is partly what we were saying before. So I assume that these are alternative hypotheses, and I will assume that the actual process that we have in the lab is unknown. So the only thing that we know about this process C is that it has either one causal structure or the other, but we don't know the specific details of which functional relationship there is between variable A and B and C. So we will take a worst case approach over this black box, consistently with the fact that the promise is that we have either one causal structure or the other. So the important parameter will be the probability of error as a function of the number of times I probe the black box. So if you look at large numbers, so when you probe the device many times, the important thing is the rate at which the probability of error goes to zero. It's easy to show that the probability of error will go to zero, as long as the two hypotheses are distinguishable, as I was assuming, as long as you don't have an intersection between the two hypotheses, you will see that the probability of error goes to zero, and it will go to zero exponentially fast, because this is what happens when you do statistics for n times. So what you want to see is that what is the exponential rate of decay of the probability of error? And the rate is usually defined like this in information theory. So you take the log of the probability of error. Probability is a number between 0 and 1, so the log is a negative number, and that's why you put a minus in front. And then you divide by n. In this way, you will see how fast is the exponential decay of the probability of error with the number of experiments you do. So this is the important parameter that I will consider in this talk, like the discrimination rate. Try to keep this in mind. So it's minus the log of the probability, or if you want to think in another way, it's the log of 1 over the probability, divided by, kind of regularized and divided by n. So this is the parameter that I will care the most in this talk. Okay, so let me enter into a specific example, that is the one on which we have results. So the problem is the problem of identifying a causal intermediary. And I will tell you immediately what I mean by that. So what is a causal intermediary? Well, actually here I'm thinking of a complete causal intermediary. So we say that B is a causal intermediary for variable A if all the influences of A have to go through B. Right? So in a sort of space-time picture, we can think of A being a variable that is localized at a space-time point, and B to be a variable that is localized on a section of the light cone going out of A. So any way that A can influence another variable B prime should be mediated by B. Okay? So that's the situation that I will consider. And so more formally, this is the definition that I'm adopting. So I think that B is a causal intermediary for A. If B is an effect of A, so in time it would come after A, and for every other effect, B prime, that takes place after B, we can go direct, instead of going directly from A to B, we can go first from A to B and then from B to B prime. So you can decompose the process that goes from A to B prime into a process from A to B and then a process from B to B prime. So this is the kind of situation that I will consider. Again, you see here there is nothing that is specific to one physical theory here. You can consider causal intermediaries in classical theory, you can consider causal intermediaries in quantum theory, and in any theory you like. So that's the causal notion that I will use in my hypothesis. And here are the hypotheses. So you have three variables, A, B, and C. And the first hypothesis is that B is a causal intermediary for A, while the variable C fluctuates randomly from one run of the experiment to the next. So if you think of these as classical bits, what I mean here is that the probability distribution of C is uniformly random in this scenario. So the second hypothesis is that that C is a causal intermediary for A, and B now is random, is uniformly at random. So your problem is to decide which of these two hypotheses is the correct one. Okay? So as you see, this is a problem that can be formulated independently of one specific theory, and now I will kind of embed this question into different theories, like classical and quantum theory, and compare what are the rates of discrimination that we get. Yep.
So on the previous slide, can you go back a slide?
Yep.
You're defining the causal intermediary not between variable A and some particular other variable.
Yes.
Because that would be you could alternatively define something that was the complete causal intermediary between A.
No. This is like a complete intermediary for any possible other effect of A, which basically will mean in the situations that we care about, that all the information about A has been faithfully encoded into B. Well, it generally means that the map from A to B is correctable, so that you can retrieve the value of A from the value of B. And, well, we will see exactly what this means in the problem that I will care about in this talk. Okay, so these are the problems, two hypotheses, and we have to figure out which one is correct. So let's see now what is the classical solution of this problem. So I will make an assumption that makes our life very much easier. So I will assume that all these variables, A, B, and C, are random variables on an alphabet of the same size. So they could all be bits or variables of dimension d. And this dimension is the same for all of them. Why do we make this assumption? Because with this assumption, the two hypotheses become very simple. So the hypothesis one becomes that b, the value of the variable b, is a permutation of the value of variable a. So there is a kind of deterministic function from a to b, and this function is a permutation. Whereas the other variable is uniformly random, and the second hypothesis is the same, where you exchange c with b, or b and c. So now c is a permutation of a, and b is uniformly random. So you get these two situations where one of the two output variables is a permutation of the input, whereas the other variable is completely random. So now, how do you distinguish between them? Yes, do you have the answer?
No, I have a question.
Yes. I would, however, be a bit wary of having too many questions during the talk if this doesn't bring the talk to the conclusion of what I wanted to show. So, I mean, I'm happy to answer, but please do ask questions that are really necessary for what we are going to say.
Is it the case that C is meant to be uniformly random, even if I condition on both A and B? Like usually when I specify, like classically, the distribution, I condition on other variables.
No. I mean, it effectively is in this scenario, but I'm not assuming it. So that's a good thing to clarify. So I'm assuming what the assumption would be from the beginning is that that's just the marginal of variable C is completely random. So without any conditioning, well, if I marginalize over B, C is random. It turns out that since we have this condition that that B would be a complete causal intermediary, that also what you said is true. It just happens that because we chose the variable to have the same dimension, that even the stronger requirement that you are thinking of is satisfied. But it was not there by hypothesis. I didn't assume it. It just comes out from the definition. OK, so the funny thing, I shouldn't show this. So how do you do that? I mean, that's actually a problem where the kind of naive classical intuition turns out to be right. So you have one variable here. So every time we prove this process, there are two output, let's say, bits. We do four bits. So you input one value of the bit, you will get two bits out. One of the two is a permutation of the one you inputted. The other is completely random. Every time you repeat, you will have a randomly chosen value. So how do you distinguish between the two hypotheses? Let me give you a how. So the obvious thing is to initialize the input variable to a value that you know, let's say to fix that you probe to put the bit in the value 0, try 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then the variable who is a permutation of that will always have the same value. So it could be either 0 or 1, but it will always be the same because you always have the same dependence. And the variable that is random with high probability will at some point deviate from this condition. Okay, so you repeat the experiment for n times, and if you want, you can try different values of the input variable. So here is one example. So we can try for 8 times. This is the input variable. So first time is 0, then is 0, then 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, and 1. And these are the two output variables. Okay, so can you decide which one is the intermediary and which one is not? How fast can you spot the difference? I think the difference is where? So I think the difference would be...
Five.
Sorry?
Five.
In the position 5, yes. Yes, so one of the two is consistent. This one, so B would be the bit flip, so it's a permutation of A, whereas a C could have been the identity, but here you have a deviation from the identity condition. So this deviation is enough to tell you that C is the random var, is the fake effect, and B is the true effect, okay? Okay, that's the naive classical strategy. You can try you can see when the error come out. The error come out when you are so unlucky that both variables assume values that are compatible with the permutation. So if in my table this were a zero, I would be in the situation where I have no grounds to conclude on which one is the true effect. So if I'm unlucky, I can only choose at random. I can only toss a coin to decide which of the two situations is correct. So the probability of error would be 1/2 conditional on the unlucky scenario where I get two sequences that are compatible with permutations. So what is the probability to be unlucky? Well, if you try v different values, like try two values, three values, if you do that, the probability to be unlucky is the number of injective functions from a set of v values to a set of d values divided by the probability that you have an individual string, that if you repeat this for n times, this is 1 over d to the n. So if you compute that, you get, well, the number of ways to... well, of how it's called these things, not well, permutations, I think generalized permutations. So you get this number divided by d to the n. So the best thing that you can do really is to test only one value of the variable. You take 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 all the times. And then this thing would be d over d to the power n. So the probability to be unlucky would be 1 over d to the power n minus 1. So that's the best you can do for the naive classical strategy. The best choice is to always initialize the input variable to the same value. And then the probability of error will be 1/2 the probability to be unlucky. So 1/2 times d to the power n minus 1. So what is the rate of discrimination? So how fast is this probability of error decaying? Well, if you take the log, it's log d. This tells you the speed of decay of the probability of error. So the probability of error goes down basically in a way that depends on the number of distinguishable states of your classical system. Okay, that was the naive classical strategy. At the beginning, I made a big deal about considering strategies that are the most general possible. So what can we say about those strategies? Well, in principle, this is not an easy question. To consider the most general strategies is pretty much of a nightmare if you want to optimize. Yes?
Before you talk about the most general strategies, there's something I didn't understand.
Yeah.
Given that the math is arbitrary, why are you assuming that the complete causal intermediary is necessarily a deterministic function? Why are you assuming?
Because this follows from the fact that it's a complete causal intermediary.
So you're considering classical theories that are deterministic?
No. I just considered the definition I gave at the beginning.
Right.
Complete causal intermediary means that every other effect will be obtained from a process that goes from B. And the
objectively stochastic classical theory might have no set of variables.
Sure. But in this setting, if you consider a classical theory, so the notion of in many theories, the notion of complete causal intermediary implies that there is a reversible channel, that the channel from A to B is correctable. So there is another channel that corrects it. It could be a stochastic channel, but it should be correctable. That's the thing that follows from the definition. If you assume that these variables have the same dimension, the only correctable channel from a variable of dimension d to another variable of dimension d is a permutation. So it's not assumed. It's just following from the definition and from the type of, from the kind of variables that I'm considering here. I'm assuming that these variables have all the same number of distinguishable states. And this gives this condition as a result. So it's not an assumption that we have a permutation. It just follows from the definition of the problem. Thanks. Okay, so log d, remember this number. This is the classical rate for variables of dimension d. In general, yes, if you want to optimize, this becomes a bit of a nightmare. But there is a relatively recent work by Hayashi that says that if you try to distinguish between two classical channels, you can do it with a parallel strategy. So you can put these channels in parallel. You don't need to consider the most general strategies. So the best thing that you could do for two known channels would be to put them in parallel. And using this result as a starting point, we can prove that asymptotically there is no classical strategy that is better than the naive classical strategy. So this log d is really the best over all possible strategies you can consider asymptotically. Maybe in the non-asymptotic scenario you can get a little bit of an advantage from these strategies, but asymptotically the rate is log d and full stop somehow. Okay, so that's the summary. Log d is the best discrimination rate between these two causal hypotheses in classical theory where you have variables of dimension d. And this is attained by the naive strategy where you initialize the variable a always in the same value. Okay, let me go now to the quantum solution of this problem. Again, I will make the assumption that the three variables a, b, and c correspond to quantum systems that are all of the same dimension d. And as Rob's question was emphasizing, this helps me to make assumptions that are like to characterize this situation in a quite specific way. So if you take this situation where these variables have dimension d, the two hypotheses that I made in abstract before become this. So the channel from A to B, C, should be a unitary channel from A to B, so there should be some unitary matrix that goes from A to B, tensor the maximally mixed state on C. This would be hypothesis one. Hypothesis two is the same situation where you have a maximally mixed state on B and some unitary channel from A to C. This is what the hypothesis tells you. You have no idea of what these unitary channels are, what is U and what is V, but you know that the form of the process will be one of these two. And you know that if you repeat, if you test the process many times, this unitary gate is going to be the same all the time you probe the process. Okay? So we have this nice unitary form because we are considering the scenario where these variables have the same size, so the same dimension d. So we have to distinguish between hypothesis one and hypothesis two, and now we have to find what is the best quantum way to distinguish. So the obvious thing is to follow the naive classical strategy and just to repropose it in the quantum case. So we could prepare the input variable in the same quantum state many times. We could apply the channel each time and then do some measurement on the output, which I would even allow to be a completely general entangled measurement, or if you like, you can make local measurements. It's the same thing. So this is the naive version of the quantum strategy. Prepare the input variable always in the same value and see what comes out. Well, it comes out that you can compute exactly the probability of error of the naive strategy. It has a combinatorial structure. First of all, it is worse than the classical error probability. That's the first thing that we find. So we do worse than we did in the classical case. But at least we find that if you compute the rate of this, the important part is this exponential decay. So the rate is still log d. So asymptotically, this is like the classical case. For finite numbers, if you look at the probability, is worse, is polynomially worse than the classical error probability. And this is it. So this is the naive quantum strategy. No good, I would say. It doesn't really match our intuition that we should do better in quantum theory. Yes?
Get the classical strategy as a special case where you choose.
That's a good point. Well, the reason is that now, if we are in a broader theory, there are more ways that our causal hypothesis can be satisfied. Okay. So before, we only had permutations, so we had, d factorial possible functional dependencies of the effect from the cause.
You don't know what U and V are, is that?
Yeah, you don't know what U and V are. So now there is a continuous set of possibilities of ways that the effect could depend on the cause. And this makes the classical strategy kind of bad, basically. It doesn't work well because of that. So the next to naive would be to do a full tomography of our channel. So imagine that you prepare some correlated state of the input variable together with some reference system. So you prepare some correlated state psi, and you feed it through the known process many times, and eventually you combine your data in some way, turning out this into a kind of joint measurement on all the outputs. So this is what tomography would do. How well are you doing here? As well as before. So if you compute the best rate you could possibly get with tomography, you get again log d. There is really nothing more than the classical rate that you can get in this way. Okay, at this point one may get a little bit discouraged and say, okay, what are the interesting things? It seems that classical and quantum are pretty much doing the same thing when we compare systems and variables of the same dimension. Well, the thing is that guessing what the strategy is many times is not enough. We would really have to try to put our efforts and compute what is the best way of intervening in the quantum case. So this is what we did. So first we started from parallel strategies where you query this black box in parallel. You don't use adaptive schemes, just put the black box in parallel. But now we consider generic ways of testing the black box. So before, in the naive strategies, I always had a product. So this variable, the different repetitions of the input variable were not correlated. Now I will allow quantum correlations between the input variables. And I will consider two scenarios. One where you only have the input variables and no reference system, and one case where I have the input variable and the reference system down here. So we'll analyze these two cases separately. Well, you may ask why. So since this is more general than this, why don't you go immediately to this? Well, the reason why I proceed in this way is that the solution in this case will help us to understand what is the solution in this case. So let me first give you the solution. When I allow myself to entangle the inputs of these black boxes, but I don't allow myself any way to have a reference system in my lab. Can anybody guess what is the solution? No. Yes.
Doing them independently?
Sorry?
Independently? Like I'm guessing entanglement doesn't help.
Oh, you guess entanglement wouldn't be helpful here. Well, I'm very happy you said that because it will not be the case. So you helped me making the point that our intuition here is not enough. I think we really need to sit down and try to understand how the problem works and not just try to guess. I would not have guessed. After I show you, you would probably say, yes, that's the way it should be. But before I show you, and I was very careful not to put the paper on the archive before giving the talk. before I show you, you would probably not guess. Probably you seem to.
I have a question.
Yes?
Is C important here? Because had you defined the hypothesis test as either B is a complete causal intermediary for A, or it's not.
Yes. And the other variable is completely random. It's uniform.
No, what I'm saying is you don't even need to talk about C. You could just say there's a channel from A to B. Either they're connected and B is the causal intermediary, mm-hmm. or they're not causally connected at all. And so B. When said, maybe when you said the other variable, you meant B, say, or B is just independent of A.
Yeah, I mean, for the actual calculation I did, the numbers we found out depend on the fact that that the variable that is not an effect will be uniformly random. This changes the probability of error, but I don't think that this will change the essence of the result. If that variable is uncorrelated but in some other state, I think the result should be the same. But we haven't, as I was saying, the intuition in this case can be really defying us. So I would like to stick to the case that we really analyzed and where we know what the answer is. Yeah, Dom?
Fan it out into a GHZ.
That's almost getting there, yes. Well, now I think we guys are ready to hear the actual solution. So for this case, where we don't use a reference, well, the best thing is to prepare singlet states. Singlet states, so imagine that we had our variables are qubits, our quantum systems of dimension 2, and now let's imagine that the number of time we probe the process is even, so that I can divide the n input variables into groups of two, so into pairs. So the optimal strategy turns out to be to prepare each pair in a singlet state. Well, why so? Because the singlet state is invariant under unitary changes of basis. So the problem was that we didn't know which unitary we had, but when we apply an unknown unitary twice to the singlet will remain the same. So we get rid of that problem that we don't know the functional dependence between the cause and the effect by choosing a quantum state that is entangled and removes that dependence. So we don't have to care anymore about the particular unitary that we have there because our input state will kind of wash out this dependence. So somehow the idea of this optimal strategy is that we use a sort of complementarity between discovering the causal structure in the best possible way and discovering the specific causal dependence between the input and the output. So we give up the possibility to discover U, so that's the opposite of tomography. We give up the possibility to discover what the process was, and we only care about discovering which causal structure the process has. So that's the intuition of why this strategy is optimal. And if you do the calculation, well, if you do it in dimension D, there is the d-dimensional version of the singlet, where you use a completely antisymmetric tensor to build the coefficients. If you do the calculation, you find that the error probability is 1 over 2 times d to the power n. If you remember, the classical probability was 1 over 2 times d to the power n minus 1. So we've done a little bit better than classical now by giving up the possibility to discover the functional dependence between cause and effect. But in terms of rate, we haven't done much better because the rate is still log d. So it seems we are again stuck to log d as the best rate of discrimination for causal hypothesis. Okay? So that's the moral of this part of the problem. So if you don't allow a reference system, you can have a slightly better probability than the classical one, but same rate. Okay, now the key point of the whole talk is what happens when we allow for a reference. So let's allow a reference. We could play again the game of you guessing, but probably we would lose more time, and I think I have only 5 minutes to get myself to the end of the talk. So let me give you how you build the optimal strategy with a reference. Let's again stick to the case where we think of qubits and when the number of times we probe the process is even. We know that without the reference, the best way is to partition our inputs into pairs. Well, however, there are many ways you can do that, okay? There are many ways you can partition n systems into pairs of two. For example, you could test your process by preparing a singlet of the first and the second U's, the third and the fourth, the fifth and the sixth. But equivalently, you could also do this. You could prepare a singlet between the first and the third, the second and the fourth, and the fifth and the sixth. And so on. There are many ways you can partition the inputs into pairs. And all these ways would all give the same probability of error, and they would all be optimal if you don't allow for a reference system. So you see where I am going. In quantum mechanics, we have the ability also to create superpositions of different scenarios. So one thing you may want to try here is to create a superposition of all possible ways you could have set up your test and run all them together in parallel, whatever that means. I mean, mathematically, it has a clear meaning, and operationally it has, but the interpretation of that could be a little bit controversial. So you have these strategies, and now, okay, let's try to follow the idea that we could probe the setup in all these different ways in a superposition. So you could say that you could correlate the choice of configuration with the value of a quantum system. And then you could do this and superpose it with another way of doing, and superpose with another way, with another way, with another way. And you could choose a bunch of different configurations and run them in a superposition that is entangled with the state of a control system. So practically, this means that you are creating an entangled state where you entangle the reference system with the configuration of the experiment, with the choice of way you connect the systems. And what we find is this, that if the configuration you choose, so you will choose a bunch of configurations. Now you consider how many of them are linearly independent. So if you have R linearly independent configuration, the probability of error will have this expression, which for large number of linearly independent configuration, it gives you the classical scaling, d 1 over d to the power n, times the number of ways you can, of setups you superposed in the experiment. So now the question of the rate is like, how big can R be? So what is the maximum dimension of the space of linearly independent configurations that I can superpose? And it turns out that this R can grow, well, pretty much as big as d to the power n, up to a polynomial factor. So this makes the rate double than the classical rate, because these equivalent configurations give you another d to the power n in the denominator. So you have an exponentially better probability of error, which means that you have a linearly better rate here. So you have the rate becomes twice the classical rate. So that's the key point of the talk, that now we found that using this curious idea of equivalent setups in a superposition, we have been able to go beyond the log d that was the classical scaling. A little bit of an extra comment on the, well, okay, so this is just a summary. So we got to a rate twice the classical rate with this trick of preparing singlets in a superposition of different configurations. So now the question you can ask again would be, what about the most general quantum strategy? At the beginning, I was, again, emphasizing that we care about these general interventions. So in principle, we would have to optimize over all the red part of the circuit and minimize the probability of error. This can be done with the framework of quantum testers that we defined here. And equivalently, this is the same formulation that was considered by Gutowski and Waltrus in their work on quantum strategies. Either way, the framework is the same. This optimization is not an easy thing to do. I mean, the framework is nice, but the cases where you can really solve the problem are a small subset of the problems you can consider. So how do we find, do we say anything about the best quantum strategy? Well, in this case, it turns out that there is an easy trick. You can define what we call the fidelity divergence of two quantum channels. It means that you take two quantum states, rho 1 and rho 2, that have a certain fidelity, the fidelity between rho 1 and rho 2, and you see how much the action of the two channels, C1 and C2, splits the two states apart from each other. So you start from rho 1 and rho 2, you apply C1 to rho 1 and C2 to rho 2. In general, you will go further apart. So if you try to go as far as possible apart, you have this quantity that is the fidelity divergence between two channels. And it's kind of easy to prove that the probability of error, if you want to distinguish between two channels in n steps, is lower bounded by this fidelity to the power n divided by 4. So this quantity gives you a lower bound on the smallest probability of error you can possibly have. This means that this gives you an upper bound on the rate at which the probability of error goes to zero. So the rate cannot be larger than minus log of the fidelity divergence. So we use this little trick. We computed the fidelity divergence between the two channels that we had, assuming even that we know what are the unitary gates. The fidelity divergence is 1 over d squared, which gives you a bound of the rate that can be at most 2 log d. So it doesn't matter what fancy intervention you will use. For finite n, you can possibly do a little bit better, but asymptotically, you will never reach a rate that is larger than the rate I showed to you before. So in conclusion, this 2 log d is asymptotically the optimal quantum rate for the problem I considered, and is achieved by this superposition. Okay, so I'm now, okay, we did it also for more than two hypotheses. That's kind of obvious. If you have more than two, you could have many candidates to be the intermediary. And we found, again, the same results. Independently on how many hypotheses we have, asymptotically with n, the classical rate is log d, quantum rate without reference log d, and the best quantum rate is 2 log d. Okay, so summarizing, what I presented was a framework in which you can talk about causal hypotheses in a theory-independent way, so that you can first formulate a problem and then embed it in different theories. As a particular example of question you can ask in that framework, I consider the problem of identifying the causal intermediary. And basically, we solved the problem for classical variables of dimension d and for quantum variables of dimension d. In one case, we found this log d, and the other was 2 log d, obtained by this weird superposition of equivalent configurations. So there are a lot of open questions. I think I will not read them. I will leave them to the discussion. These are more like questions of what does this mean for the foundations of quantum theory? Could we imagine that we can characterize quantum theory as the general probabilistic theory that gives us the maximum advantage in testing causal hypotheses? Or maybe that's not true and we will need a principle to say what is the exact amount of advantage that we get in quantum theory, like why 2 log d and not 3 log d, as we could get in some other physical theory. So this suggests that maybe we could have one day an axiomatization of quantum theory that uses as axiom tasks and features that have to do with causal hypothesis testing or causal discovery. And the last obvious question is, what happens if we have non-standard hypotheses on the causal structure, like indefinite causal order? Like, how well can we distinguish the hypothesis of a definite causal order from the hypothesis of an indefinite causal order? This connects to talks you will hear in the afternoon. So that was all. Thank you very much for your attention.
Suppose that I use a different pair of hypotheses. So it concerns a channel that has just one output, B.
Mm-hmm.
No output, C.
Mm-hmm.
A input, B output.
Yeah.
And the two causal hypotheses are B is a complete causal intermediary for A. So it's basically a cause-effect relation.
Yeah.
And the other is B is causally independent of A.
Yeah, that's another problem.
It seems to me everything you said would probably work for that case as well. Because in some sense, by having B and C, you sort of have two handles on which is the channel that is cause-effect and which is the channel that has no causal connection. Which is the one I phrase, you just have one handle on it.
Yeah.
So like in your classical version, you could look at a long string of outputs B, and you could say, do they always track A according to some function, or do they not?
Yeah.
And then get the chance that you're unlucky, and even though there's no causal connection, they still track it, is exactly what you wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that it might be the simpler version
that
of
is
the problem,
yeah.
And this kind of can be built on top of it.
Could be, but as I said, what I learned from this is that our intuition before we actually sit down and solve the problem could be really going in the opposite direction of what we are thinking. So I would be very happy if that were the case, because for the moment, this is the one example I know where there is a really a quantitative advantage I can prove by running all these techniques. I would be very happy. I mean, the first obvious direction is to try to see how generic these results are. I don't know if I wrote it here. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, even the fact that quantum theory is better than classical theory when we compare variables of the same dimension is something that came out of the calculations, but I wouldn't be able to say that this has to be true a priori. I mean, even finding that, proving that this is always true is something that has yet to be done.
Two things. Can you say a few words about how you optimize? And the second thing is, in the case where you have the reference ancilla, how do you use that in the final measurement?
Okay, let me try to answer. It's not easy to answer because how do we really optimize? Is it through a complete machinery of group theory, representation theory, combining spaces together, using this and things we know about state discrimination? So, I mean, that's a pretty substantial part of the paper that is basically the appendix, because it's not the main point, but it's really the main work that we have been doing.
Difficult.
Yes, it's not, I mean, difficult or easy, depending on the habits of the persons who are working. It was difficult enough for me. I mean, I'm sure that our people would say, ah, that's easy, I can do it in a snapshot, but it was difficult enough for me. Especially, I mean, I must say, the part that I glossed over, the one with k hypotheses instead of two, so one variable can cause B1 or could cause B2, B3, B4, B5, Bk. The result in the end is the obvious result, that nothing changes. Proving that took a good 6 months. I mean, that was really the most substantial part of the work is actually the one that I've been glossing over, because it required a lot of techniques. Now you were asking, the other question was like, how is the ancilla being used in the end? I'm afraid that my answer will be a little bit disappointing, because what we do in the end, in the case where we have only two hypotheses, is just to pick the best quantum measurement to distinguish between two states. So it's not that we are, I don't know, measuring the ancilla in the Fourier basis and doing something on the system based on the outcome. Maybe yes, but what we did was just to consider the optimal Hellstrom measurement to distinguish between rho 1 and rho 2. The probability of error depends on the distance, on the trace distance between the two states. So we actually computed the trace distance to compute the probability. So we know what the measurement is, but I wouldn't be able to offer much intuition of what the measurement is actually doing or whether there is a suboptimal measurement that has a kind of nicer physical interpretation. I suspect there actually may be something like measuring the ancilla in the Fourier basis, taking maximum advantage of the complementarity between the choice of setups and the causal structure. But for the moment, what we have is just purely Hellstrom measurements, the usual mathematical technique for the optimal measurements.
One final question.
So this is for the worst case scenario, right?
Yes.
So it could be that the classic is much better. Like in the optimal case that there is no measurement error, basically, then you just know with the first deviation.
What if for the optimal case? So what do you mean? Can you say again?
So there is an assumption of a measurement error, and you're like an error in.
Yeah, I mean, the assumption is that I don't put any restriction on the strategies. So in a sense, the assumption is that there shouldn't be any assumption here. So just consider like this problem where I have this quantum channel or a classical channel. I can probe these channels for n times and I allow myself every sort of strategy that is allowed by one physical theory or by the other. So that's the assumption, that there is no restriction on which strategies I allow myself, except for the restriction that I am in one theory or in the other theory. Your question was, but from your question, you asked, so this is about the worst case scenario. What about the situation where I have a prior on which particular processes I have? So instead of saying I have a permutation, I don't know anything about the permutation, I say, okay, I have a prior on which permutation is there. And in the quantum cases, I can say, okay, I have a prior on which particular unitary channel is there. I suspect that actually not much is changing because of the following. All the proofs of optimality I have, both in the classical and the quantum case, are made in that way. Are made of saying, forget the fact that you don't know what these two channels are. Imagine that you know them. Imagine that you know which unitary gate you have. How well can you distinguish if you restrict your strategies to one form or the other? And then we have upper bounds on the rate. So like the log 2, 2 log 2, 2 log d being optimal came from an argument like that. And even classically, I think you can use the Chernoff bound. Actually, no, not I think. We did use that. So if you want to say, okay, this log d is the best I can do, I say, imagine that I even know what permutation is acting, what is the maximum, the minimum probability of error, and even in that scenario, would get log d as a rate. So in terms of rate, the result is quite robust under changes of the setting. The thing that really technically is a bit of a challenge if these channels are not permutations of unitaries, because this makes the analysis horribly complicated. So here there is a bit of a compromise between the difficulty of the problem that we can solve and trying to make the result more practical, but that's how it is here.
Okay, then let's thank Giulio again.
Thanks a lot.